Green Mars, Cassette 3.
Part 2. The Ambassador. Asteroids with elliptical orbits that cross inside the orbit of Mars are called Amor asteroids. If they cross inside the orbit of Earth, they're called Trojans. In 2088, the Amor asteroid, known as 2034b, crossed the path of Mars some 18 million kilometers behind the planet, and a clutch of robotic landing vehicles originating from Luna docked with it shortly thereafter. 2034b was a rough ball about 5 kilometers in diameter with a mass of about 15 billion tons. As the rockets touched down, the asteroid became New Clark. Quickly, the change became obvious. Some landers sank to the dusty surface of the asteroid and began drilling, excavating, stamping, sorting, conveying. A nuclear reactor power plant switched on, and fuel rods moved into position. Elsewhere, ovens fired, and robot stokers prepared to shovel. On other landers, payload bays opened, and robot mechanisms spidered out onto the surface and anchored themselves to the irregular planes of rock. Tunnelers bored in. Dust flew off into the space around the asteroid and fell back down or escaped forever. Landers extended pipes and tubes into each other. The asteroid's rock was carbonaceous chondrite with a good percentage of water ice shot through it in veins and bubbles. Soon the linked collection of factories in the landers began to produce a variety of carbon-based materials and some composites. Heavy water, one part in every 6,000 of the water ice in the asteroid, was separated out. Deuterium was made from the heavy water. Parts were made from the carbon composites, and other parts, brought along in another payload, were brought together with the new ones in factories. New robots appeared, made mostly of Clark itself. And so the number of machines grew as computers on the landers directed the creation of an entire industrial complex. After that, the process was quite simple for many years. The principal factory on New Clark made a cable of carbon nanotube filaments. The nanotubes were made of carbon atoms linked in chains so that the bonds holding them together were as strong as any that humans could manufacture. The filaments were only a few score meters long, but were bundled in clusters with their ends overlapping, and then the bundles were bundled until the cable was 9 meters in diameter. The factories could create the filaments and bundle them at speeds that allowed them to extrude the cable at a rate of about 400 meters an hour, 10 kilometers a day, for hour after hour, day after day, year after year. While this thin strand of bundled carbon spun out into space, robots on another facet of the asteroid were constructing a mass driver, an engine that would use the deuterium from the indigenous water to fire crushed rock away from the asteroid at speeds of 200 kilometers a second. Around the asteroid, smaller engines and conventional rockets were also being constructed and stocked with fuels, waiting for the time when they would fire and performed the work of attitude jets. Other factories constructed long-wheeled vehicles capable of running back and forth on the growing cable, and as the cable continued to appear out of the planet, small rocket jets and other machinery were attached to it. The mass driver fired. The asteroid began to move into a new orbit. Years passed. The asteroid's new orbit intersected the orbit of Mars such that the asteroid came within 10,000 kilometers of Mars, and the collection of rockets on the asteroid fired in a way that allowed the gravity of Mars to capture it in an orbit at first highly elliptical. The jets continued to fire off and on, regularizing the orbit. The cable continued to extrude. More years passed. A little over a decade after the landers had first touched down, the cable was approximately 30,000 kilometers long. The asteroid's mass was about 8 billion tons. The cable's mass was about 7 billion. The asteroid was in an elliptical orbit with a periapsis of around 50,000 kilometers, but now all the rockets and mass drivers on both New Clark and the cable itself began to fire, some continuously, but most in spurts. One of the most powerful computers ever made sat in one of the payload bays, coordinating the data from sensors and determining what rockets should fire when. The cable, at this time pointing away from Mars, began to swing around toward it, as in the pivoting of some delicate part of a timepiece. The asteroid's orbit became smaller and more regular. More rockets landed on New Clark for the first time since that first touchdown, and robots in them began the construction of a spaceport. The tip of the cable began to descend toward Mars. Here, the calculus employed by the computer soared off into an almost metaphysical complexity, and the gravitational dance of asteroid and cable with the planet became ever more precise, moving to a music that was in a permanent retard, so that as the great cable grew closer to its proper position, its movements became slower and slower. If anyone had been able to see the full extent of this spectacle, it might have seemed like some spectacular physical demonstration of Zeno's paradox, in which the racer gets closer to the finish line by halving distances. But no one ever saw the full spectacle, for no witnesses had the senses necessary. Proportionally, the cable was far thinner than a human hair. If it had been reduced to a hair's diameter, it would still have been hundreds of kilometers long. And so it was only visible for short portions of its entire length. Perhaps one might say that the computer guiding it in had the fullest sensation of it. For observers down on the surface of Mars in the town of Sheffield, on the volcano Pavonis Mons, Peacock Mountain, the cable made its first appearance as a very small rocket descending with a very thin leader line attached to it, something like a bright lure and a thin fishing line being trolled by some gods in the next universe up. From this ocean-bottom perspective, the cable itself followed its leader line down into the massive concrete bunker east of Sheffield with an aching slowness until most humans simply stopped paying attention to the vertical black stroke in the upper atmosphere. But the day came when the bottom of the cable, firing jets to hold its position in the gusty winds, dropped down into the hole in the roof of the concrete bunker and settled into its collar. Now the cable below the aerosynchronous point was being pulled down by Mars's gravity. The part above the aerosynchronous point was trying to follow New Clark in centrifugal flight away from the planet, and the carbon filaments of the cable held the tension, and the whole apparatus rotated at the same speed as the planet, standing above Pavonis Mons in an oscillating vibration that allowed it to dodge Deimos. All of it controlled still by the computer on New Clark and the long battery of rockets deployed on the carbon strand. The elevator was back. Cars were lifted up one side of the cable from Pavonis, and other cars were let down from New Clark, providing a counterweight so that the energy needed for both operations was greatly lessened. Spaceships made their approach to the New Clark spaceport, and when they left, they were given a slingshot departure. Mars's gravity well was therefore substantially mitigated, and all its human intercourse with Earth and the rest of the solar system made less expensive. It was as if an umbilical cord had been retied. He was in the middle of a perfectly ordinary life when they drafted him and sent him to Mars. The summons came in the form of a fax that appeared out of his phone in the apartment Art Randolph had rented just the month before, after he and his wife had decided on a trial separation. The fax was brief. "Dear Arthur Randolph, William Fort invites you to attend a private seminar. A plane will leave San Francisco Airport at 9 a.m., February 22, 2101. Art stared at the paper in amazement. William Fort was the founder of Praxis, the transnational that had acquired Art's company some years before. Fort was very old, and now his position in the Transnat was said to be some kind of semi-retired emeritus thing. But he still held private seminars, which were notorious, although there was very little hard information about them. It was said that he invited people from all subsidiaries of the Transnat. But they gathered in San Francisco and were flown away by private jet to someplace secret. No one knew what went on there. People who attended were usually transferred afterward, and if not, they kept their mouths shut in a way that gave one pause. So it was a mystery. Art was surprised to be invited, apprehensive, but basically pleased. Before its acquisition, he had been the co-founder and technical director of a small company called Dump Mines, which was in the business of digging up and processing old landfills, recovering the valuable materials that had been thrown away in a more wasteful age. It had been a surprise when Praxis had acquired them. A very pleasant surprise, as everyone in Dump Mines went from employment in a small firm to apprentice membership in one of the richest organizations in the world, paid in its shares, voting on its policy, free to use all its resources. It was like being knighted. Art certainly had been pleased, and so had his wife, although she had been elegiac as well. She herself had been hired by Mitsubishi's Synthesis Management, and the big transnationals, she said, were like separate worlds. With the two of them working for different ones, they were inevitably going to drift apart, even more than they already had. Neither of them needed the other anymore to obtain longevity treatments, which Transnats provided much more reliably than the government. And so they were like people on different ships, she said, sailing out of San Francisco Bay in different directions, like ships, in fact, passing in the night. It had seemed to Art that they might have been able to commute between ships if his wife hadn't been so interested in one of the other passengers on hers, a vice chairman of Mitsubishi in charge of East Pacific Development. But Art had been quickly caught up in Praxis's arbitration program, traveling frequently to take classes or arbitrate in disputes between various small Praxis subsidiaries involved in resource recovery, and when he was in San Francisco, Sharon was very seldom at home. Their ships were moving out of hailing distance, she had said, and he had become too demoralized to contest the point and had moved out soon after on her suggestion. Kicked out, one could have said. Now he rubbed a swarthy, unshaven jaw, rereading the facts for the fourth time. He was a big man, powerfully built, but with a tendency to slouch. Uncouth, his wife had called him, although his secretary at Dump Mines used the word bear-like, which he preferred. Indeed, he had the somewhat clumsy and shambling appearance of a bear, also its surprising quickness and power. He had been a fullback at the University of Washington, a fullback slow of foot, but decisive in direction and very difficult to bring down. Bear man, they had called him. Tackle him at your peril. He had studied engineering and afterward worked in the oil fields of Iran and Georgia, devising a number of innovations for extracting oil from extremely marginal shale. He had gotten a master's degree from Tehran University while doing this work, and then had moved to California and joined a friend who was forming a company that made deep-sea diving equipment used in offshore oil drilling, an enterprise that was moving out into ever deeper water as more accessible supplies were exhausted. Once again, Art had invented a number of improvements in both diving gear and underwater drills, but a couple of years spent in compression chambers and on the continental shelf had been enough for him, and he had sold his shares to his partner and moved on again. In quick succession, he had started a cold environments habitat construction company, worked for a solar panel firm, and built rocket gantries. Each job had been fine, but as time passed, he had found that what really interested him was not the technical problems, but the human ones. He became more and more involved with project management, and then got into arbitration. He liked jumping into arguments and solving them to everyone's satisfaction. It was engineering of a different kind, more engrossing and fulfilling than the mechanical stuff, and more difficult. Several of the companies he worked for in those years were part of transnationals, and he got embroiled in interface arbitration not only between his companies and others in the transnats, but also in more distant disputes requiring some kind of third-party arbitration. Social engineering, he called it, and found it fascinating. So when starting Dump Mines, he had taken the technical directorship and had done some good work on their Super Rathjis, the giant robot vehicles that did the extraction and sorting at the landfills. But more than ever before, he involved himself in labor disputes and the like. This trend in his career had accelerated after the acquisition by Praxis. And on the days when work like that went well, he always went home knowing that he should have been a judge or a diplomat. Yes, at heart he was a diplomat. Which made it embarrassing that he hadn't been able to negotiate a successful outcome to his own marriage. And no doubt the breakup was well known to Fort, or whoever had invited him to this seminar. It was even possible that they had bugged his old apartment and heard the unhappy mess of his and Sharon's final months together, which wouldn't have been flattering to either of them. He cringed at the thought, still rubbing his rough jaw, and drifted toward the bathroom and turned on the portable water heater. The face in the mirror looked mildly stunned. Unshaven, 50, separated, misemployed for most of his life, just beginning at his true calling. He was not the kind of person who he imagined got faxes from William Fort. His wife or ex-wife-to-be called, and she was likewise incredulous. "It must be a mistake," she said when Art told her about it. She had called about one of her camera lenses, now missing. She suspected that Art had taken it when he moved out. "I'll look for it," Art said. He went over to the closet to look in his two suitcases still packed. He knew the lens was not in them, but he rooted loudly through them both anyway. Sharon would know if he tried to fake it. While he searched, she continued to talk over the phone, her voice echoing tinnily through the empty apartment. "It just shows how weird that Fort is. You'll go to some Shangri-La, and he'll be using Kleenex boxes for shoes and talking Japanese, and you'll be sorting his trash and learning to levitate, and I'll never see you again. Did you find it?" "No, it's not here." When they had separated, they had divided their joint possessions. Sharon had taken their apartment, the entertainment center, the desktop array, the lectern, the cameras, the plants, the bed, and all the rest of the furniture. Art had taken the Teflon frying pan. Not one of his best arbitrations, but it meant he now had very few places to search for the lens. Sharon could make a single sigh into a comprehensive accusation. "They'll teach you Japanese, and we'll never see you again. What could William Fort want with you?" "Marriage counseling," Art said. Many of the rumors about Fort's seminars turned out to be true, which Art found amazing. At San Francisco International, he got on a big, powerful private jet with six other men and women, and after takeoff, the jet's windows, apparently double-polarized, went black, and the door to the cockpit was closed. Two of Art's fellow passengers played at orienteering, and after the jet made several gentle banks left and right, they agreed that they were headed in some direction between southwest and north. The seven of them shared information. They were all technical managers or arbitrators from the vast network of Praxis companies. They had flown into San Francisco from all over the world. Some seemed excited to be invited to meet the transnational's reclusive founder. Others were apprehensive. Their flight lasted 6 hours, and the orienteers spent the descent plotting the outermost limit of their location, a circle that encompassed Juneau, Hawaii, Mexico City, and Detroit, although it could have been larger, as Art pointed out, if they were in one of the new air-to-space jets, perhaps half the Earth or more. When the jet landed and stopped, they were led through a miniature jetway into a big van with blackened windows and a windowless barrier between them and the driver's seat. Their doors were locked from the outside. They were driven for half an hour. Then the van stopped, and they were let out by their driver, an elderly man wearing shorts and a t-shirt advertising Bali. They blinked in the sunlight. They were not in Bali. They were in a small asphalt parking lot surrounded by eucalyptus trees at the bottom of a narrow coastal valley. An ocean or very big lake lay to the west about a mile, just a small wedge of it in sight. A creek drained the valley and ran into a lagoon behind a beach. The valley's side walls were covered with dry grass on the south side, cactus on the north. The ridges above were dry brown rock. Baja? One of the orienteers guessed. Ecuador? Australia? San Luis Obispo, Art said. Their driver led them on foot down a narrow road to a small compound composed of 7 two-story wooden buildings nestled among seacoast pines at the bottom of the valley. 2 buildings by the creek were residences, and after they dropped their bags in assigned rooms in these buildings, the driver led them to a dining room in another building where 6 kitchen workers, all quite elderly, fed them a simple meal of salad and stew. After that, they were taken back to the residences and left on their own. They gathered in a central chamber around a wood-burning stove. It was warm outside, and there was no fire in the stove. Ford is 112, the orienteer named Sam said, and the treatments haven't worked on his brain.
They never do, said Max, the other orienteer.
They discussed Fort for a while. All of them had heard things, for William Fort was one of the great success stories in the history of medicine, their century's Pasteur, the man who beat cancer, as the tabloids inaccurately put it. The man who beat the common cold. He had founded Praxis at age 24 to market several breakthrough innovations in antivirals, and he had been a multi-billionaire by the time he was 27. After that, he had occupied his time by expanding Praxis into one of the world's biggest transnationals. 80 continuous years of metastasizing, as Sam put it. While mutating personally into a kind of ultra-Howard Hughes, or so it was said, growing more and more powerful until, like a black hole, he had disappeared completely inside the event horizon of his own power.
I just hope it doesn't get too weird, Max said.
The other attendants, Sally, Amy, Elizabeth, and George, were more optimistic. But all of them were apprehensive at their peculiar welcome, or lack of one, and when no one came to visit them through the rest of that evening, they retired to their rooms looking concerned. Art slept well as always, and at dawn he woke to the low hoot of an owl. The creek burbled below his window. It was a gray dawn, the air filled with the fog that nourished the sea pines. A talking sound came from somewhere in the compound. He dressed and went out. Everything was soaking wet. Down on narrow flat terraces below the buildings were rows of lettuce and rows of apple trees so pruned and tied to frameworks that they were no more than fan-shaped bushes. Colors were seeping into things when Art came to the bottom of the little farm over the lagoon. There a lawn lay spread like a carpet under a big old oak tree. Art walked over to the tree, feeling drawn to it. He touched its rough, fissured bark. Then he heard voices, coming up a path by the lagoon where a line of people wearing black wetsuits and carrying surfboards or long, folded bird suits. As they passed, he recognized the faces of the previous night's kitchen crew and also their driver. The driver waved and continued up the path. Art walked down it to the lagoon. The low sound of waves mumbled through the salty air, and birds swam in the reeds. After a while, Art went back up the trail, and in the compound's dining room he found the elderly workers back in the kitchen flipping pancakes. After Art and the rest of the guests had eaten, yesterday's driver led them upstairs to a large meeting room. They sat on couches arranged in a square. Big picture windows in all 4 walls let in a lot of the morning's gray light. The driver sat on a chair between 2 couches.
I'm William Fort, he said. I'm glad you're all here.
He was, on closer inspection, a strange-looking old man. His face was lined as if by 100 years of anxiety, but the expression it currently displayed was serene and detached. A chimp, Art thought, with a past in lab experimentation, now studying Zen. Or simply a very old surfer or hang glider, weathered, bald, round-faced, snub-nosed. Now taking them in one by one, Sam and Max, who had ignored him as driver and cook, were looking uncomfortable, but he didn't seem to notice.
"One index," he said, "for measuring how full the world is of humans and their activities is the percent appropriation of the net product of land-based photosynthesis." Sam and Max nodded as if this were the usual way to start a meeting.
"Can I take notes?" Art asked.
"Please," Fort said.
He gestured at the coffee table in the middle of the square of couches, which was covered with papers and lecterns.
"I want to play some games later, so there's lecterns and work pads, whatever you like."
Most of them had brought their own lecterns, and there was a short silent scramble as they got them out and running. While they were at it, Fort stood up and began walking in a circle behind their couches, making a revolution every few sentences.
"We now use about 80% of the net primary product of land-based photosynthesis," he said. 100% is probably impossible to reach, and our long-range carrying capacity has been estimated to be 30%, so we are massively overshot, as they say. We have been liquidating our natural capital as if it were disposable income and are nearing depletion of certain capital stocks, like oil, wood, soil, metals, fresh water, fish, and animals. This makes continued economic expansion difficult."
"Difficult," Art wrote. "Continued?"
"We have to continue," Fort said, with a piercing glance at Art, who unobtrusively sheltered his lectern with his arm. "Continuous expansion is a fundamental tenet of economics. Therefore, one of the fundamentals of the universe itself, because everything is economics. Physics is cosmic economics. Biology is cellular economics. The humanities are social economics. Psychology is mental economics, and so on."
His listeners nodded unhappily.
"So everything is expanding, but it can't happen in contradiction to the law of conservation of matter energy. No matter how efficient your throughput is, you can't get an output larger than the input."
Art wrote on his note page, "Output larger than input, everything economics, natural capital, massively overshot."
"In response to this situation, a group here in Praxis has been working on what we call full world economics."
"Shouldn't that be over full world?" Art asked. Fort didn't appear to hear him.
"Now, as Daly said, man-made capital and natural capital are not substitutable. This is obvious, but since most economists still say they are substitutable, it has to be insisted on. Put simply, you can't substitute more sawmills for fewer forests. If you're building a house, you can juggle the number of power saws and carpenters, which means they're substitutable, but you can't build it with half the amount of lumber, no matter how many saws or carpenters you have. Try it, and you have a house of air. And that's where we live now."
Art shook his head and looked down at his lectern page, which he had filled again. "Resources and capital non-substitutable. Power saws / carpenters. House of air."
"Excuse me," Sam said. "Did you say natural capital?"
Fort jerked, turned around to look at Sam.
"Yes? I thought capital was by definition man-made. The produced means of production, we were taught to define it." "Yes, but in a capitalist world, the word capital has taken on more and more uses. People talk about human capital, for instance, which is what labor accumulates through education and work experience. Human capital differs from the classic kind in that you can't inherit it, and it can only be rented, not bought or sold.
Unless you count slavery, Art said. Fort's forehead wrinkled.
This concept of natural capital actually resembles the traditional definition more than human capital. It can be owned and bequeathed and divided into renewable and non-renewable, marketed and non-marketed.
But if everything is capital of one sort or another, Amy said, you can see why people would think that one kind was substitutable for another kind. If you improve your man-made capital to use less natural capital, isn't that a substitution?
Fort shook his head. That's efficiency. Capital is a quantity of input, and efficiency is a ratio of output to input. No matter how efficient capital is, it can't make something out of nothing.
New energy sources, Max suggested.
But we can't make soil out of electricity. Fusion power and self-replicating machinery have given us enormous amounts of power, but we have to have basic stocks to apply that power to. And that's where we run into a limit for which there are no substitutions possible.
Fort stared at them all, still displaying that primate calm that Art had noted at the beginning. Art glanced at his lectern screen. Natural capital, human capital, traditional capital, energy versus matter, electric soil. No substitutes, please. He grimaced and clicked to a new page.
Fort said, Unfortunately, most economists are still working within the empty world model of economics.
The full world model seems obvious, Sally said. It's just common sense. Why would any economist ignore it?
Fort shrugged, made another silent circumnavigation of the room.
Art's neck was getting tired.
We understand the world through paradigms. The change from empty world economics to full world economics is a major paradigm shift. Max Planck once said that a new paradigm takes over, not when it convinces its opponents, but when its opponents eventually die.
And now they aren't dying, Art said. Fort nodded.
The treatments are keeping people around, and a lot of them have tenure.
Sally looked disgusted. Then they'll have to learn to change their minds, won't they? Fort stared at her.
We'll try that right now, in theory at least. I want you to invent full world economic strategies. It's a game I play. If you plug your lecterns into the table, I can give you the starting data.
They all leaned forward and plugged into the table. The first game Fort wanted to play involved estimating maximum sustainable human populations.
Doesn't that depend on assumptions about lifestyle? Sam asked. We'll make a whole range of assumptions.
He wasn't kidding. They went from scenarios in which Earth's every acre of arable land was farmed with maximum efficiency to scenarios involving a return to hunting and gathering, from universal conspicuous consumption to universal subsistence diets. Their lecterns set the initial conditions, and then they tapped away, looking bored or nervous or impatient or absorbed, using formulas provided by the table or else supplying some of their own. It occupied them until lunch, and then all afternoon. Art enjoyed games, and he and Amy always finished well ahead of the others. Their results for a maximum sustainable population ranged from 100 million, the immortal tiger model, as Fort called it, to 30 billion, the ant farm model.
That's a big range, Sam noted.
Fort nodded and eyed them patiently.
But if you look only at models with the most realistic conditions, Art said, you usually get between 3 and 8 billion. And the current population is about 12 billion, Fort said. So, say we're overshot. Now what do we do about that? We've got companies to run, after all. Business isn't going to stop because there's too many people. Full world economics isn't the end of economics, it's just the end of business as usual. I want Praxis to be ahead of the curve on this, so it's low tide, and I'm going back out. You're welcome to join me. Tomorrow we'll play a game called Overfull.
With that, he left the room, and they were on their own. They went back to their rooms and then, as it was close to dinner time, to the dining hall. Fort wasn't there, but several of his elderly associates from the night before were, and joining them tonight was a crowd of young men and women, all of them lean, bright-faced, healthy-looking. They looked like a track club or a swim team, and more than half were women. Sam's and Max's eyebrows shot up and down in a simple Morse code spelling, "Aha, aha." The young men and women ignored that and served them dinner, then returned to the kitchen. Art ate quickly, wondering if Sam and Max were correct in their suppositions. Then he took his plate into the kitchen and started to help at the dishwasher and said to one of the young women, "What brings you here?"
"It's a kind of scholarship program," she said. Her name was Joyce.
"We're all apprentices who joined Praxis last year, and we were selected to come here for classes."
"Were you by chance working on full world economics today?"
"No, volleyball."
Art went back outside, wishing he had gotten selected to their program rather than his. He wondered if there was some big hot tub facility down there overlooking the ocean. It didn't seem impossible. The ocean here was cool, and if everything was economics, it could be seen as an investment, maintaining the human infrastructure, so to speak. Back in the residence, his fellow guests were talking the day over.
"I hate this kind of stuff," said Sam.
"We're stuck with it," Max said gloomily. "It's join a cult or lose your job."
The others weren't so pessimistic.
"Maybe he's just lonely," Amy suggested.
Sam and Max rolled their eyes and glanced toward the kitchen.
"Maybe he always wanted to be a teacher," Sally said.
"Maybe he wants to keep Praxis growing 10% per year," George said. "Full world or not."
Sam and Max nodded at this, and Elizabeth looked annoyed.
"Maybe he wants to save the world," she said.
"Right," Sam said, and Max and George snickered. "Maybe he's got this room bugged," Art said, which cut short the conversation like a guillotine.
The days that followed were much like the first one. They sat in the conference room, and Fort circled them and talked through the mornings, sometimes coherently, sometimes not. One morning he spent 3 hours talking about feudalism, how it was the clearest political expression of primate dominance dynamics, how it had never really gone away, how transnational capitalism was feudalism writ large, how the aristocracy of the world had to figure out how to subsume capitalist growth within the steady state stability of the feudal model. Another morning he talked about a caloric theory of value called eco-economics, apparently first worked out by early settlers on Mars. Sam and Max rolled their eyes at that news, while Fort droned on about Tenyaev and Takarova equations, scribbling illegibly on a drawing board in the corner. But this pattern didn't last, because a few days after their arrival, a big swell came in from the south, and Fort canceled their meetings and spent all his time surfing or skimming over the waves in a bird suit, which was a light broad-winged bodysuit, a flexible fly-by-wire hang glider that translated the flyer's muscle movements into the proper semi-rigid configurations for successful flight. Most of the young scholarship winners joined him in the air, swooping around like Icaruses and then dropping in and planing swiftly over the cushions of air pushed up by every breaking wave, air surfing just like the pelicans that had invented the sport.
This ends side one of cassette 3. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.